The hour of 10:35 having arrived, we'll call the tax committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Schultz will move approval of the minutes from January 12th, 2017. Any discussion?
Second.
Don't need a second. All in favor say aye. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. But thank you for the second anyways. Okay. So let's go to, before we go to introductions, Let's do introductions here, and then we will go to the department. You know what? We've got a lot of people who can come here. We do have a quorum, but we will just hold off a second on introductions until we get some more folks here. So with that being said, we're very privileged today to have Mr. Paul Cummings with the department with us. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please, I guess I just did, but you need to do it too for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Cummings, and I am the tax policy manager for the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, and members, just and for anyone that's paying attention, this is from our last meeting. We always give the department a chance to talk on bills before, so this is Mr. Cummings' comments on the estate tax bills that we heard last week. Mr. Cummings, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, first I wanted to just put on the record a very hearty thank you from the Department of Revenue and from the administration for the quick passage of federal tax conformity. I think, as you know, Mr. Chair, there are hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who will benefit from that legislation. It was a good bill, and we certainly appreciate your partnership, and we think it's a sign of good things to come, Mr. Chair. So thank you.
And Mr. Cummings, I would also like to thank the governor for signing that bill, House File 2, and for Commissioner Bowerly and all of your efforts on that. And I hope it is a preview of good things to come, because good things can happen. We helped a lot of Minnesotans with House File 2. We really did, working together, and hopefully we can continue that. Mr. Cummings.
So, good morning. Late last week, I reached out to the bill authors, Representative Loon, McDonald, and Fisher, and left messages with their offices. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and we appreciated the thoughtful and deep debate last week. I listened carefully to the discussion and to many of the perspectives offered. I offer this testimony as a way to put one perspective on the record, not to revisit the debate or invalidate other perspectives last week. As we put together a state budget, we have to ask ourselves, how do we build a framework that works for all Minnesotans? The state budget, including the tax bill, will represent choices about priorities, Mr. Chair. Even the Don't Stop Believe in Tax Bill, as it passed the House floor, had to place priorities on which provisions to include and which not to include, from the committee hearing process to the final House bill. As the committee considers the many changes that will come before it, we think it would be helpful to have some context about the number of people affected by the proposal, the proposed tax law changes. For example, Mr. Chair, under current Minnesota law, approximately 6% of deaths in the state are required to file under the estate tax, yet only 2.5% of those have any estate tax due. An even smaller percentage will see relief under these bills, except for Representative McDonald. Well under 1% of Minnesotans pay the estate tax each year. With tens of thousands of Minnesotans feeling uncertainty about how to pay for their health care, tuition set to rise at our colleges and universities, parents trying to figure out how to pay for quality child care, small cities trying to ensure that they have clean drinking water, farmers having to pay a large portion of debt service bonds for schools in some areas of the state, we start to see that to ensure broadly shared prosperity in the state, other priorities are also important. As we consider all of the regions in our state and the diverse needs of our people, the policies brought forward today provide generous tax cuts to a very small set of estates in Minnesota that represent less than 1% of Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, I won't belabor the point because it was discussed in detail last week, but without the estate tax, many unrealized capital gains would go untaxed in Minnesota. This happens when an asset that has increased in value is not sold during the owner's lifetime. Under the current tax system, capital gains tax is due on the appreciation of assets such as real estate stock or an art collection only when the owner realizes the gain, usually by selling it. The increase in value of an asset is never subject to the income tax if the holder holds on to that asset until death. These unrealized capital gains account for a significant proportion of assets held by large estates that pay the estate tax. Unrealized capital gains make up 25 to 30% of the worth of estates worth between $3.5 to $10 million, and 55% of the value of estates worth more than $100 million. Those are national numbers, Mr. Chair. During Governor Dayton's time in office, Minnesota has already made important changes to the estate tax. The small business and qualified farm deductions passed in 2011. I believe that was your bill, Mr. Chair, already provide relief to family farms and small businesses being passed down. About 300 estates claim the small business and or farm property subtraction per year. Fewer than 10 estates annually claim the maximum subtraction, meaning fewer than 10 are paying the estate tax each year in those areas. In 2014, the governor and legislature took action again on the estate tax, raising the exemption above $1 million. In fact, those tax changes are still taking effect, Mr. Chair, with the estate tax exemption having increased to $1.8 million this year, and it will increase again to $2 million next year. Earlier this month, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith proposed changes to the estate tax law so that where farmland is acquired by government units through eminent domain, an heir would not have to pay the recapture tax for inherited farmland subject to the estate tax. This provision was part of House File 848, and we ask for your consideration as part of the omnibus tax bill this year. The estate tax is the most progressive tax in the state, according to the tax incident study. As you know, Mr. Chair, overall, Minnesota has a regressive state and local tax system, meaning effective tax rates are lower for those with higher incomes compared to middle-income Minnesotans. Increasing or eliminating the estate tax will make our system more regressive, which means that middle and lower income Minnesotans will be paying for a larger share of the services we all share and depend on. The estate tax is a component of the revenue system that helps ensure fiscal balance for our state. As we move forward in this session, we look forward to continuing to discuss priorities for tax expenditures and the many priorities related to tax law changes. If this bill moves through the process, the department looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representatives Loon, McDonald, and Fisher, members and staff. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cummings, for that. Just a couple housekeeping notes. One is, for some members have come to me and many government relations professionals and are wondering if there's at some point where we just take House File 848, throw it on some bill, and repass it, or do these things have to have new hearings? Every bill that will be put together in a new tax bill, we want to hear it here. We're basically starting over is what we're doing, just so members know and the government relations professionals know that that's what the chair's intention is. And to your point, Mr. Cummings, on the governor's estate tax provision in his proposal, I do really like that. That's a good one. We can do more, but that is a good start there. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, I really appreciate your conversation. And you bring up a point about unrealized capital gains in regards to that. So help me understand the estate taxes that are in the estates that are under the threshold that we currently have. How are those capital gains recognized at the current process?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, I think I will defer to the experts on this, Mr. Michael or Ms. Michael.
I don't know the answer. Oh, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Michael. Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg, the unrealized depreciation that, you know, is covered by a stepped-up basis for estates not subject to the estate tax, either federal or state, will not be taxed. There's no, you know, there's essentially no way that they become taxed. So, and many of the proposals, you know, proposals at the federal level to repeal the estate tax typically also involve repealing the step-up in basis. So, for example, in that 1 year when there was no estate tax or it was sort of an optional estate tax, the estates that elected to not pay estate tax also elected step-up basis. But most of the federal proposals that would repeal the estate tax still have a substantial, essentially threshold for where they allow a step-up in basis based on a family size. So most of those proposals still would not tax most of those unrealized gains for lower value estates.
Representative Petersburg?
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification, because that does seem that there is, as an aggregate, a lot of the smaller estates' realized capital gains are not being taxed at this point. And so, therefore, it would make sense that if you excluded most of the public and only included that tax for some, it would be very progressive. So thank you for the clarification.
Other questions? Chair Carlson.
Yeah. Question of... I guess, Mr. Michael, it's clear to me the step-up in basis, let's say if you own stock and you bought it at $5 a share and it went to 10, that the heirs would be just transferred and there'd be no tax even though it had increased in value. Is that correct?
Mr. Michael?
And then I have a follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, then the follow-up question I have, is that true with semi-retired teacher, and a lot of teachers participated in things like tax-sheltered annuities, state employees, deferred comp? Does it work the same way with those investments?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, no. Retirement plans, essentially, the tax has to be. So if you inherit an IRA, the individual that inherits the IRA will end up paying income tax on the distributions from the IRA, and minimum distribution rules, unless you're a surviving spouse, will apply. So you'll be required, even if you're, you know, in under 59 and a half, you'll be required to start taking minimum distributions from that IRA. There's no additional tax if you're under 59 and a half, though. It's just regular income tax.
Or, Mr. Michael, there's no penalty either.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I mean, the Internal Revenue Code calls that additional 10% a tax, but most people think of it as a penalty.
It's a penalty. And then for the spouse would be for an RMD when the spouse hits 70 and a half. Okay.
No, Mr. Chairman, I mentioned I had a follow-up, or I guess two follow-ups. Then with a deferred comp or tax-sheltered annuity, the heirs, as I understand it, can take that out over a period of time, which might reduce the tax liability. Is that correct?
Well, what they get is an inherited IRA, and they take an RMD based upon their age, whatever that is at that time.
Yeah, and then the payout would be over...
Over a period of time.
Life expectancy, I guess, is right. What I'm saying.
Okay. Without any additional 10% IRS tax.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. People oftentimes refer to that as a stretch IRA. Yes, so they can take it over there. There's the IRS table that tells you how slowly you can take that.
Well, I would have additional questions relative to the inheritance tax then, but I'll defer to others.
And members, it's my intention. I've got quite a list here, which is fine. At 11 o'clock, is it okay with the department? You won't feel slighted if I shut her down and then bring you up on some other stuff?
No, Mr. Chair. We look forward to talking about residency and reciprocity as well, Mr. Chair.
You know, these are such exciting subjects. I mean, they're just page turners. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, my question for you is, how many FTEs do you have currently dedicated to management of the estate tax?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't know, but I can get an answer to that question.
That'd be
Chair
helpful.
Anderson.
Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, you mentioned the stats and statistics about how many people are actually subjected to the estate tax. Has the department ever studied how many people leave our state to avoid the estate tax? Studies I've read are suggesting that we're losing about $2.1 billion of adjusted gross income annually. And when these people are moving out of the state, they're taking about $20 billion of assets with them. Think about the economic impact of not telling our grandparents they have to leave. And by keeping them here, the economic impact of their spending, their demand for services, the capital that they possess that would potentially be used for investment in Minnesota. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because the estate planning industry delivers prima facie evidence that this is occurring, and that the estate tax does influence moving decisions with regard to the elderly and those who are retiring. And it also shows that it is really happening. So do you have you studied the economic impact of not having an estate tax and how much more revenue might actually be in the state as a result of people not leaving?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, we have not done such a study. Mr. Chair, much of the research that we do is based on the tax code. I know that our state demographer has done some work in terms of migration, people moving in and people moving out of the state, but we don't. That's something that more something in terms of the demographer, in terms of what they do. In terms of looking at the research or evidence, we're trying to find some sort of verifiable research, and we haven't found any that is sort of that we know that people are making decisions because of another decision in terms of causality. So that is, but you know, Mr. Chair, we and Representative Hertas, we certainly appreciate the discussion and the types of examples that people are talking about.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question actually was very similar to Representative Hertas, but just a question. Just considering some of the, I think, approximately 37 other states that don't have the estate tax, I'm wondering, Mr. Cummings, if any research in following other states' finances and policies found it that they didn't have the revenue to help with the programs and the health care and taking care of the poor or the sick, if those revenues were not available because those states repealed their estate tax. In your testimony, you said that if we did so, it would be regressive and we'd have less money to help with our education and our health care and the things that we say are a priority. So just curious if any research in the other states, when they repealed their estate tax, were they too then loss of revenue to help pay for some of those core principles?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, there when people are trying, you know, some of the articles that I've read that are certainly not research, a lot of people are finding to move to various areas of the country because of various things like amenities or the weather. I mean, the weather is a big reason that people move. But if you're seeing the types of reasons why, then we're seeing people move back. It's because they are finding that the healthcare system in Minnesota, the various ways in which they can access sort of the type of life in terms of trying to be close to their family. So I'm not sure, you know, in terms of your question about priorities, if there's a $1.4 billion surplus, how do we best spend that to increase shared prosperity in our state? If the exemption is, you know, if the estate tax is removed, there are other things that cannot be provided. But in terms of people making choices in terms of where to live, typically it's something we're seeing about weather. But if they are making choices based on the quality of services, you know, people are picking Minnesota. And that's something that I think is important as we're talking about the priority of removing the estate tax. We need to set that at the same par as removing other types of services or amenities that people rely upon.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Very good. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Cummings, why would anybody leave Minnesota because of the weather? I know not these things. Okay, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've just heard from Representative McDonald that the states that did repeal the estate tax, are they more likely to have fewer people leaving those states? Do you know of any research that suggests when you repeal the estate tax, people are more likely to stay in that state? And what are the trends over time?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, many states have taken action, whether it's based on the estate tax or various inheritance taxes over time. There are states that have tried to move towards more progressive tax systems and increase that tax. There are states that have removed it. But in terms of the migration trends tend to be similar. It tends to be people moving towards warmer climates, irregardless of what is going on in terms of the tax structure. So, I think there may be, there are some things that we can really put an impact on that can ensure that we continue to have a high quality of life. I don't know if this committee has jurisdiction over our climate, Mr. Chair, but maybe you can try and pick up that that budget area, that budget account, maybe next year, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schultz still has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No more questions.
Okay. Your name was mentioned, Representative McDonald.
Yes, as my name was mentioned. I just, for those migration skeptics, I don't know why you would continue to deny the fact that there are billions of dollars and many, many folks in the state leaving the state, partially in due to our tax laws, and the weather certainly contributes. But I testified last week that in my little small circle of friends in the Delano Wright County area, I have five folks that left this state with their fortunes and wealth and all the good things that they do in philanthropic activities have left because of the tax climate. And certainly that's not an exception to the rule. That is happening all over the state. So they continue to deny that, and you want to see empirical data and facts. Well, if that's not the facts that you are seeing friends and family leaving because of that, then you're not opening your eyes very wide. Because, folks, it's happening.
Mr. Cummings, is the Department of Estate Tax denier?
As I said, Mr. Chair.
A flat earther.
As I said, Mr. Chair, I think we did listen closely to the discussion that happened on Thursday. We appreciate the discussion. My comments are not meant to invalidate the types of stories or experiences that people brought to the table. So that is certainly not my intention in bringing forward my question.
And I appreciate that. As I said earlier, we're going to cut this off here at 11. I've got a long, long list of people that have questions. So please contact, if you're on the list, please contact Mr. Cummings with your comments or questions. So with that, we're going to go into introductions. We are going to do introductions today, and then we have three bills up. So as I said, I've got a long list, and I don't mean to cut anybody off, but please talk to Mr. Cummings. He's very accessible and does a very good job at what he does. And I had a question. I'll ask you later.
Oh.
Okay. No, be fair. I'll ask you later. I missed it. Okay. Man, can't get my own name on there. Okay. With that, let's start with Representative Marquardt for introductions.
Very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, I'm Paul Marquardt, State Representative, and represent all our parts of Becker, Clay, and Norman County. And we used to go around the room, Mr. Chair, and your committees, and talk about how many parades we went to, kind of an indicator of rural or whatever. So, and I think I'm at about 12 or 13 in a summer.
Representative Marquardt, is that how many you have or how many you go to?
That's a good point. It's a little bit back and forth.
Right, the last weekend of session, I have three parades, and guess where I'm at? I'm here, so I missed three of my 19, like, boom, like that. So, but this is a parade. No, this is a zoo. Circus, yeah. Okay, thank you. So you got about 12 of them?
12 or 13, depending on the year. Sometimes they don't always have them. But again, it's an honor to serve on this committee and an honor to serve as the DFL lead with you. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very glad to have you here. Chair Carlson.
Yeah, I'm Lyndon Carlson, and I represent parts of three suburbs, Crystal, New Hope, and Plymouth. I no longer have a total of a suburb in my district. At one time, I had the entire city of Robbinsdale, but with redistricting, that changed. If we're going to talk about parades, basically, There's one parade in my, I have to say, area now, but it does draw a lot of people from my district, and that's the Robbinsdale Whizbang Day Parade. And I started being in that parade in 1972, the first time I ran, and I never have missed the Robbinsdale Whizbang Day Parade since. And it probably draws anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people. And they still draw heavily from my district of Crystal and parts of New Hope in particular. So it's very worthwhile to participate in the parade. But it's kind of the grandparent of, I think it may be older than the Aquatennial Parade, if I'm not mistaken. But
Chair Carlson, is it physically located in your district?
Not any longer. That's why I have
zero parades.
It used to be down one of the main streets in Robbinsdale, but I'm pointing out that it still draws heavily in terms of people from my district, so I still participate. And I've never missed one of those parades. But I just wanted to comment, you know, somebody when you had the minutes moved or said second. And many years ago I was chairing a health care committee, and we were dealing with a very controversial issue. And somebody made a motion. We entertained the motion and voted. And this fellow came charging up to me, and he was just really upset. He said, "You voted on that, and you didn't even ask for a second." So I had to explain a little bit to him. You know, he was an average citizen. What we operate a little differently under Masons, and a second isn't required. And then I pointed out, when I said, and when you think about it, that's even more democratic than if you were under Roberts, for example. Any individual can put a question before the body. And that's one of the strong points, I think, of Masons. But I'll stop there.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Diane Loeffler, and I have the pleasure of representing 15 neighborhoods in northeast and northern southeast Minneapolis. And for those of you who don't know the cities as well, a neighborhood is kind of like a small town. And some of them have little small commercial nodes, and some used to that haven't quite survived. I've got some that are heavy, mixed, industrial, and residential that were, you know, back in the days when you walked to your job because you didn't have anything other than horses to get there. So our history is evident in our land uses, and it causes some tensions occasionally.
Representative Loeffler, can you explain the comment north, southeast?
Northern southeast.
Well, northern southeast.
Northern southeast Minneapolis, because most of southeast is in Representative Ilhan Omar's district.
It's kind of drawing a hot water heater.
You know, when you,
sure why you
yeah, when you represent a city that has 81 neighborhoods, how you communicate about where things are geographically has those fine points, like northern southeast Minneapolis.
I understand that. I understand that. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jen Schultz, and I represent Duluth, the east part of the city of Duluth, which would be District 7A. And I'm not sure how many parades we have. We don't have very many because they're expensive to operate a parade. But we do, the best parade is the Christmas City of the North Parade in December, which is always well attended, especially in a snowstorm.
Now, Representative Schultz, you do not have Lincoln Park, is that correct?
Lincoln Park is District 7B. That's Rep. Olson's district.
That's
Who's not that? Right. That's Liz Olson that took over for Eric Simonson.
Is that a freshman?
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk to him next term.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I only said second to be purely honest with the committee, or as former Representative Rooker Vina would have said, brutally honest, because I was jealous of Duluth for always getting to do it. So I figured the Iron Range has to have a voice in St. Louis County, and it was my opportunity to do so today.
Sometimes you just have a little bit of disappointment.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair, you do. And my parents do it quite well. that being said, we do have a lot of fun parades in my district, since it's a theme in today's introductions, eight of them that I am able to attend, and a few other smaller ones that I make it to when I can, but eight regulars. For anyone who hasn't been to the Eveleth fireworks, we have a heck of a time. So come up over the 4th of July, and you can hop around in town. I do recommend taking a cab. There are a lot of festivities. If Representative Anderson were here, he'd probably have a Galdang, or a, what was it, a Galdam beer from his brewery, which he does owe me one of those. someday I'll take them up on. But I do consider myself the best-looking Iron Range representative on the tax committee since, well.
Ansel's probably.
Ansel's. That's it, Mr. Chair.
President Applebaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is John Applebaum. I'm serving my second term for District 44B, which includes my hometown community of Minnetonka, as well as Plymouth and the entire city of Woodland. Very excited to be here, be a part of this committee, and looking forward to another wonderful session representing my hometown at the Capitol.
How many parades?
Three parades, none physically located in my district.
What do you do all summer? I mean, zero and three? I'm sorry. President Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm John Lesch. I represent District 66B, which includes a little bit of the east side, north end, Hamlin Midway, and Como Park, where I live. And I am proud, Mr. Chair, to represent the folks of that district. But just found out about 3 years ago when I was doing this Ancestry.com that I also represent my great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents who were all dead in Calvary Cemetery, the big Catholic cemetery there in my district, where all the people that are dead people don't vote, and they pay their taxes, by the way, also. But I found out all the folks that were there generations before I moved there to represent it were of my family. I'm very proud of that. Two parades, Mr. Chair. One, the Payne Arcade Harvest Festival over on Payne Avenue on the east side. And the other one is the Rice Street Parade, which, and if any of you are familiar with the Rice Street Parade, what you do is you watch the parade, drink a lot of beer, and then after the parade you drink more beer, and then you fight with the cops. It's a tradition. Well, you winced at that, but it's a fine tradition on Rice Street, Mr. Chair. It's happening much less lately than it used to. But the Rice Street Parade and the Rice Street Festival is a fabulous time. For those of you who are down here in July, I highly recommend it.
And let's go, Ms. Manzi.
Nina Manzi, House Research Department. I work on individual income tax and property tax refund.
You have a parade in your community?
Mr. Chair, I live in Woodbury, and we have a parade during Woodbury Days, which is at the end of August.
Okay. Mr. Michael.
Joel Michael, House Research. I work on corporate and estate tax and a bunch of sub minor taxes.
Parade in your city?
I live very close to the Capitol, and there is a parade down Selby Avenue, which is, I don't know what the name of it is.
Mr. Rubis.
Stephen Rubis, committee administrator, and I'm now very interested in this Rice Street Parade.
Greg Davids, District 28B, Fillmore and Houston Counties, 19 parades.
Kelly Windsor, I am the committee legislative assistant. I'm new to Representative Loeffler's district. Did you say there were any parades?
Great. There are.
Are you in the south?
We'll make sure you're invited.
I'm in the northeast part.
Joe McDonald from District 29A, Wright County, City of Delano. I have seven parades, including the St. Patrick's Day Parade on the Saturday before St. Patrick's at Maple Lake. And then Delano has the oldest and largest 4th of July parade in the state of Minnesota. So I'm there often as well. So does Annandale, who's in my district. Just for my folks in Annandale, you have a great parade, but it's not the oldest and largest. But anyway, seven parades, and I make them mostly all of them.
It's younger and smaller.
Younger and smaller.
Yep. Are we supposed to
Chair Draskowski. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Draskowski. I represent portions of Winona, Wabasha, Goodhue, and Dodge County. And counting up, we've got 12 or 13 parades in my district, Mr. Chair. And I'm happy to report that none of my communities use LGA for their parades. As a matter of fact, it doesn't cost much for parades by us. It's all volunteer. And that includes the Riverboat Days Parade, the Watermelon Festival Parade, the Cheese Festival Parade, Rose Festival Parade, 4th of July Parade, Covered Bridge Days Parade, Volk Fest Parade, Goodview Days Parade, Corn on the Cob Days Parade, Cheese Days Parades, Survival Days Parades, and I can't remember There's Cheese Days and Cheese Fest. You have to have it right, folks. And then there's the Lewiston Parade, and I can't remember what that one's called, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
What's Survival Days Parade, Representative?
That's West Concord, Mr. Chair.
West Concord?
West Concord survived a difficult time in their history, and I don't remember the rest of the details, but they celebrate surviving.
They're still here.
Just today. Gary Kay, GOP Research, and no parades last year, but I did go to the Delano Parade when you were mayor back in the day.
President Petersburg.
John Petersburg. I represent 24A, which is south of here, Owatonna, Wauseka, down right along I-35 south of there. I might have the record on the most oddity. I walk in 6 parades every year, none of which are in my district because none of my any of the parades that might be in my district do not allow political contestants in it. So
I love those cities.
So I walk around it because that's where everybody goes.
President Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have 10 parades in my district, McLeod-Sibley County, and they were founded much earlier than Wright County, by the way, just for the record. I'm prohibited from participating in 2 of the parades. But the we understand that. They do vote for me, but they won't let me be in the parade for some reason.
They don't let school board.
And as long as we're talking about parades and circus, I did marry into a circus family. I do have pictures if anybody wants to see them. It was called Jay Gould's Million Dollar Circus, and when he died, he was penniless. The elephant ate all the profits. But the IRS, there was no estate tax payable because there was no money, but on the form, he said the elephant ate all the profits, and the IRS is still after him, even though he died in the early 70s.
So what does your opponent have for float in those parades that you're not allowed in?
They bar all politicians.
Oh, okay. Kosnick.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. John Kosnick from Lakeville, about 25 miles south along the interstate, and I represent Lakeville. We celebrate our 50th anniversary of the Panorama of Progress in Lakeville, more commonly known as Pan-O-Prog, and we try to keep it just under 3 hours. So come on down to Lakeville, have some fun.
I'm busy that day. Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And I represent parts of Chisago County, Schaefer, Franconia, and then parts of much of Washington County with Forest Lake, Scandia, Meridian, St. Croix, May Township, Stillwater Township, and parts of Stillwater. Now, I have 3 parades, but in Orono is the largest parade in the state. I would say Forest Lake 4th of July parade is the largest one in the state. We'll have to figure that out. So
we'll have House Research get on that. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am blessed, and I only have 1 parade. I represent the city of Plymouth, and it is in my district. And it is probably one of the shortest parades that you will ever participate in. If you don't count the lineup, it's about 2 blocks long.
Representative Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jennifer Loon, I represent Eden Prairie and have about 2/3 of the city. And, there's kind of a parade, but not really. We have a big 4th of July celebration at Round Lake Park in Eden Prairie where lots of people come out during the day. We have a marvelous fireworks display in the evening, but they have a kiddie parade, so kids come and decorate up their bikes, and or maybe parents put the little ones in a wagon that are decorated up with 4th of July decorations and balloons and that, but not a full-fledged parade. I'm sorry to say. I wish we had one.
Chair Knobloch.
Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Knobloch, State Representative 14B. First elected in 1994, representing the roughly the south and west part of St. Cloud, Waite Park and St. Augusta, served till 2006, decided to not run again, was gone 8 years, moved, now represent the north and east side of St. Cloud. And since it is a tax committee, I should mention that once upon a time I did earn my CPA certificate, although I have long been what they call in the profession a social CPA, in that I have long been inactive and don't take any of those continuing ed type courses. But in terms of parades, I have one parade, Granite City Days, in my district. I do a total of three parades, counting that one. And, Mr. Chair, if I had 19 parades, I don't think I'd be doing this job.
Before we continue here, one of my parades is in the city of Wayland, Minnesota, which is 62 residents. Well, 60, the Smiths moved. But so there's 60 there's 60 residents, and it's a very small town, and it's a standstill parade. All the unions come to the parade, okay, and then the people walk around it. The band plays, the color guard's there, the whole, it's awesome. Okay. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Drew Christensen. I represent Savage in Western Burnsville. Savage is home to the world famous Dan Patch Days Parade because we are the home of Dan Patch.
Cool. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jerry Hertas. I represent District 33A, which is the western one third of Hennepin County. There's 11 urban, suburban, ex-urban cities out there, including Greenfield, Corcoran, Independence, Loretto, Maple Plain, Medina, Wayzata, Long Lake, Minnetrista, St. Bonnie, Orono. Did I say Wayzata? I think not. But we have a number of parades in our area, but probably even more than parades, we have festivals that are a week-long period of drinking beer. And so these communities have week-long celebrations. Probably our most popular parade is the James J. Hill Parade. And even Representative Applebaum joins the James J. Hill Parade. In fact, I've even observed this last cycle. He even puts his signs up in my district. But maybe he's trying to coerce people to move from Wayzata to Minnetonka. Maybe the taxes are lower there or something. I don't know. But so that that might be an explanation. I think the parade I'm least favorable with is the parade of people leaving my district because of the estate tax and the income tax.
We're done with that issue for the day, by the way. We'll go to Chair Erickson, but we do learn things. Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lewiston is Heartland Days Parade, Mr.
Heartland
Chair.
Heartland Days Parade. And I didn't really – thank you, Representative Marquardt, for having us do this because I didn't – I don't know if I knew that Chair Knobloch had passed a CPA test, and I just wanted to know if you knew what a CPA was compared to an actuary or what an actuary – do you know what the comparison is?
You mean in terms of the test, Mr. Chair?
No, a CPA is like an actuary that has a personality.
That's
Chair Erickson.
All right.
Chair, I'll be hearing from the actuary. Just kidding. Chair Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sandra Erickson, and I represent the counties of Mille Lacs, Sherburne, and Kennebec. I've been walking in parades since I managed former Representative Leroy Copendreyer's campaign. So I date back to 1990. So the number of parades I walked in is, I can't even count them. But I have 14 of them still that I walk in, and then I help out others, like my senator. The Senate district has Big Lake Becker, and so I often participate. Elk River. I don't represent Elk River, but I go there. I love parades, so I've been doing this forever, and I think when I retire, I'll have, withdrawal from parades because it's big. Thank you.
Representative Metza.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Chair Erickson.
It's just been sticking with me. And Representative Lesh, Iron Rangers have always found it easier and less trouble after if you run from the police, not attack them. So.
Okay, let's go. I see Molly, or Ms. Dalton.
I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. I do sales tax, local sales taxes, local government aid, levy.
And your parade?
Violet Parade is the kitty's parade that we hear at our annual block parade.
Awesome. Molly?
I'm Molly Richardson with DFL Research. I live in Minneapolis. I grew up in San Luis Park with the park
Wonderful. Next.
Hi, Cynthia Templin. I do state taxes, House Fiscal Department, non-property taxes, basically. I live in Mendota Heights, but I do really enjoy going to the Halloween parade.
All right, yeah. Let's go back. Mr. Hines?
Steve Hines, House Research. I do most areas of property taxes, property tax simulations, and county program aids. And this past year, I attended the 4th of July parade in Cable, Wisconsin.
Ooh.
Go Packers.
Mr. Williams. Ooh. Thanks, Steve. Or Mr. Hines.
I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to be working with Mr. Hines on property taxes this year. I'm also going to be working on our models and simulations at House Research. And I occasionally attend the Mayday Parade in South Minneapolis.
All right.
I'm Chris Kleinman, also at House Research. I handle alcohol, tobacco, excise taxes, minerals taxes. I also handle legal issues related to property taxes, like property tax administration issues, delinquency, tax forfeiture. As far as parades, one of my, I guess, favorite parades I've been to is the Snowplow Parade. I think that's in Frazee, Minnesota, or at least it was at one point. That was a good one.
Nice. First time I met, so that's your guy.
Good morning. Kathy Schill, I do property taxes, refunds, aids, and credits. And I live in New Brighton, and we have Stockyard Days. And what I found out with Stockyard Days, it's where the railroads would bring livestock and dogs would herd them all. And I don't have to buy a dog license for my dog because it would be ridiculous with that horse, historic perspective of having all of those dogs licensed because they were all working dogs.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Cool.
Committee pages.
Sure, my name is Isaac Winnes. I'll be the committee page for you this session.
Where are you from?
I'm from South Minneapolis. Grew up there right by Minnehaha Falls and Lake Thomas.
Oh, that's beautiful. Beautiful area there. Where did you go to college?
I actually just graduated from high school in the spring, so I was homeschooled for that.
Which high school? Oh, homeschooled?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a team name?
Probably your family.
Okay. Okay, other pages. Representative Slocum. We're introducing ourselves and saying how many parades we have.
I'm Linda Slocum, and I represent East, Central, and the western edge of Richfield, and East and Central Bloomington. And parades, I parade in the Richfield Grand Day Parade on the 4th of July, which is really a hot one, let me tell you. And because I see a lot of my old students. And so I always have a Mustang, Ford Mustang convertible, because my guy who loaned me his Jaguar convertible had to sell it to get his kid through school. And I'm not kidding. So I sit in his convertible, and I see some of my old students. And I grab them, and I drag them into the convertible, hopefully not when it's moving. And then they ride with me and do the, you know, the wave. And for part of the parade, then they run back. And then we have the Bloomington Heritage Days, which is shorter, and it's fun, but the 4th of July Grand Day Parade is the best.
Oh, Litchfield Dragons.
Richfield.
Oh, Richfield. I think you said Litchfield. I thought, why are you going to Litchfield
in
a Jaguar?
Richfield.
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 There you go.
Spartans.
Spartans. Mighty Spartans, if I remember correctly. Okay, thank you very much. I think we're going to go down, and we're going to take care of House File 183. Out of order, but it is my bill, so we're going to do it anyways. Okay, so House File 183. Wisconsin reciprocity terms modified. I would like to just make a few comments on the bill. First of all, I would move an amendment to get the bill in the order I'd like, so I'll move the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. Okay, here's what we just did. For years, let's back up a little bit. Governor Pawlenty stopped. We have reciprocity with three states. North Dakota, Michigan, and we had with Wisconsin. Governor Pawlenty canceled Wisconsin's reciprocity because Wisconsin would never pay their bills on time, basically is what happened. And we're talking over $100 million. So that was canceled. And so I think every year since then, or almost every year,
I've had a bill in to reestablish reciprocity with Wisconsin. It was usually carried in the Senate by Senator Reinert or others from Duluth. We would get the Duluth legislators on the House bill because it's Minnesotans really get hammered at no fault of their own because the effective tax rate on the lower income brackets is actually higher in Wisconsin, believe it or not. And so people that live in Minnesota, work in Wisconsin, can pay up to $1,000, $2,000, whatever the number is, more in state. Now, we're not estate tax, state taxes, because we do not have reciprocity with Wisconsin. So the bill 183, before we just amended it, was the way it was introduced last year. Very broad bipartisan support. Former Chairman Chesky was always there and helped me out on this thing when she was chair. As when I was chair in the past, it was in those bills. And we would, in the bill, we would say you will negotiate with Wisconsin, you will cut the deal for reciprocity, kind of like we had before, and life is good. And Governor Dayton and Commissioner Franz at the time and Commissioner Barley worked very, very hard to get this done. We'd have meetings with Wisconsin folks. I'd be there. And Governor Dayton really worked to try and get this thing reinstated. Commissioner Franz worked very hard on it. And some people say, oh, Governor Dayton doesn't, you know, in my area, I'll go to meetings and say, oh, Governor Dayton didn't do this under his process. They say, no. See, that's not the way it is. Governor Dayton's office and himself have made very strong attempts to get this thing renegotiated. So last year what we did in House File 848 is we said, okay, you know, working with Wisconsin, you might as well be talking to a stump when it comes right down to it. So what we did was we said, okay, what we're going to do with the Department of Revenue, we're going to have them issue a check for the amount of money that people lose because they live in Minnesota and work in Wisconsin. And so we've worked very hard on the DE-1 amendment, which was actually in House Bill 848 last year, that says we're doing tax reciprocity with Wisconsin, and we're doing it. And Wisconsin, do whatever you're going to do. We're going to take care of this from Minnesota. So with that, I would move the bill to lay it over for possible. Well, just wait. I moved it. We put the amendment on. Now we have it before us. So what I would do, is there anyone from the audience wish to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns on the bill? Let's bring the department up if we could here. And I'll be very clear on this one. This has been very bipartisan. The governor's office has made every attempt that I could see to try and get this thing reestablished, and it just, when I said negotiating with a stump, I meant it. It's kind of mean to stumps, actually. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, I thought that your overview was quite eloquent, so I'm going to try and condense my remarks to try and ensure that we're not covering the same ground. Income tax reciprocity allows residents who live in one state but work in another to file income tax return only in their home state. Mr. Chair, as you sort of alluded to, Minnesota and Wisconsin had reciprocity for many, many years prior to 2002. Governor Ventura proposed termination of the agreement at that time because of the negative impact of the timing on the payment for Minnesota. It hit a breaking point in 2009. Governor Tim Pawlenty was concerned about the need to wait for 15 months for a reciprocity payment to be received. Because of that agreement in 2010, Minnesota Commissioner of Revenue Ward Innes terminated the agreement in September of 2009.
Where is he?
Effective for tax years 2010.
Oh, he left.
He left. So a 2011, there was a 2011 law, Mr. Chair.
There he is.
A 2014 law in order to try and bring back a reciprocity agreement. And as you noted, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Franz and Commissioner Bowerly have at numerous points talked to their counterparts in Wisconsin. There have been meetings and there had been offers in order to try and do that. And they try to bridge the divide to protect Minnesota's interests while providing relief to impacted workers on the borders. Our efforts have not yet been successful. Mr. Chair, you talked about what reciprocity is, and that is something that I will not talk about again. But as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, Wisconsin does have a lower statutory rate for the middle class, but they also have smaller personal and dependent exemptions, along with lower standard and itemized deductions. That means Wisconsin has a higher effective tax income tax rate for middle-income workers because the Wisconsin tax is higher than Minnesota tax for most taxpayers. Wisconsin's position lowers results in a lower reimbursement payment. Overall, under the bill as not amended, Mr. Chair, Minnesotans would be expected to subsidize Wisconsin's higher overall effective income tax rates on middle-income workers for a little over $6 million per year. And I know that your bill, Mr. Chair, does cost about $6 million as well. This bill provides tax preferences to Minnesota individuals who work in Wisconsin. We must be aware of the message that this sends to Minnesota's businesses on the border who see the state granting tax benefits to those who find employment outside of the borders. Mr. Chair, the underlying bill, and I think there are two things to talk about as we talk about this, and one is the reciprocity agreement, which I will talk a little bit about, Mr. Chair, as the underlying bill, because that seems to be talked about quite a bit, and I wanted to make sure we're on the record about that. And then I'll talk a little bit about the credit as amended, Mr. Chair. So a reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin would allow 80,000 taxpayers the convenience of filing income tax return only in their home state. Of those, 24,000 are Minnesota residents and approximately 56,000 are Wisconsin residents. The proposed agreement in this bill would result in less withholding for the state in which the worker is earning the money, which is disproportionately Minnesota, as many Wisconsinites work in Minnesota, and there are some in pockets of, say, southeast Minnesota, Mr. Chair, who work in Wisconsin. Under the draft without the amendment, we have a significant payment of the amount of tax to Minnesota from Wisconsin. So that revenue estimate shows that the payment is estimated to be between $90 and $100 million. On November 21, 2016, it was reported that that in the current legislative term, the state of Wisconsin will face a deficit of nearly $700 million. This is important because in 2015, it was reported that Wisconsin had failed to make payments to creditors. So we must not only consider the $6 million cost, but the uncertainty of the larger $100 million payment of Minnesota's net revenue loss. This has the possibility of impacting Minnesota's fiscal health. In addition, Mr. Chair, your underlying bill specifically removes a provision directing the Commissioner of Revenue to work in the best interest of the people of the state. So we're concerned, obviously, that if there would tend to be forcing an agreement, that we could have an agreement that certainly may not be in the best interest of the state. Mr. Chair, I just have looked at the credit language. I know this is almost either exact or close to what had passed in 848. The credit would be complicated. It would add another line on the form. And we have not yet gone through all of the determinations for what that would mean for taxpayers in order to provide additional justification. So we don't know what additional paperwork they would have to file. We haven't yet determined whether they could be filing electronically or we would have to ask them to file in a paper form because of the additional things that they would have to represent to the department. So I just wanted to note that the credit, while is a creative solution to fix the problem for affected taxpayers on the border, that there still are issues that we'd be more than happy to continue to talk to you about throughout the session, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, and we will solve those. You made a good point that we get rid of the whole $100 million going back and forth. That's just gone.
Right.
The only downside, I didn't know quite how to do this, but we'll work with you, is they would still file returns in both states.
That's right.
Which under full reciprocity, they wouldn't have to. Yeah. So, questions? Chair Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, I wonder, Mr. Cummings or perhaps staff, if you could tell me, would it be legal for us to charge Wisconsin residents what they would pay on their Wisconsin income for our state income tax. I mean, if they would be paying more in Wisconsin and they're paying less here, if they're working here, could we legally charge them what they would be paying if they were paying at Wisconsin rates? And can you comment on the pros and cons of doing that?
Mr. Cummings?
Well, I am going to defer to our experts, Mr. Michael and Ms. Manzi. I know that they already have to file in each state. And even if it was tend to find out because of the interactions between credits that they do pay higher taxes in Minnesota, they would have to pay that because of the types of credits that they have. But I'm going to defer to Mr. Michael.
And I would also say that because we've not been able to come to an agreement with Wisconsin, that's tough for them. Yes, people working with living in Wisconsin, working in Minnesota, would, well, Mr. Michael or Ms. Mann, Mr. Mike.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I think it can fairly clearly say that that would be unconstitutional. The reason why I can say that is another state already tried it, and the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down. Back in the 70s, New Hampshire, which does not have an income tax on wages, but has a lot of people from Maine who work in New Hampshire, I think in Portsmouth, had the brilliant idea that that would be a great way to raise revenue by imposing an income tax on Maine residents who worked in New Hampshire. And so they did that, and, of course, their theory was those it's a wash for those residents of Maine who work in New Hampshire because Maine will give them a credit for the New Hampshire income tax paid. And the U.S. Supreme Court struck that down as violating the privileges and immunities. When there was actually a suit between the states. Sure and enough. So I'm sure if we tried to do this, it would have the, you know, the same effect.
Chair Nava.
Well, I guess that answers my question.
Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cummings, just by way of a quick background, you know, this isn't the only reciprocity agreement that we have with Wisconsin. And we had a representative years ago from Rochester, Ken Zube, who was from your side of the aisle. But we have tuition reciprocity. That's a big one with Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota. And he didn't care for reciprocity, so he would introduce a bill. And in those days, Wisconsin would talk. But then they wanted to put all of the reciprocity agreements on the table to be renegotiated when he was trying to back away from the tuition reciprocity. And I think in addition to the income tax reciprocity, I think at that point in time we even had one dealing with the gas tax somehow. I don't know if that still exists or not, but some sort of a payment because it dealt with truckers in particular filling up on one side of the border. And maybe that's ancient history, but at any rate, when you look at all the reciprocity agreements, some of them have advantages one way or another between the states. So my question then of Mr. Cummings is, as you've attempted to talk to Wisconsin, have they tried to put other reciprocity agreements on the table?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, in the work that has been done since I joined the department in early 2011, there has not been a broader discussion of other reciprocity-type agreements on top of tax reciprocity. There are many times in which when we talk to legislators about tax reciprocity, as you're talking right now, many of them are starting to say, well, don't we have reciprocity in other areas? But in terms of the negotiations with Wisconsin, we have been working directly with the Secretary of their Department of Taxation or Revenue over in Wisconsin. And we've been sort of trying to narrow it to tax reciprocity, and we have been unsuccessful, Mr. Chair.
And Chair Carlson, to your question, I've attended a lot of these meetings, and the reciprocity in other areas has not even brought up that I recall. It was strictly tax reciprocity, income tax reciprocity. Chair Carlson.
Yeah, well, this was at an earlier point in time, and all I'm saying is that it turned out to be, for those of us, and I was chairing Ed Finance at the time, and we dealt with reciprocity with all of our neighboring states except Iowa, which never has totally agreed with reciprocity. But all I'm saying is that when we were trying to deal with Wisconsin on the tuition reciprocity, then they wanted to put other forms of reciprocity on the table because the payments back and forth. Their argument at the time was when you looked at all of the reciprocity, it was actually fairly balanced. It wasn't balanced from our perspective on the tuition side at that point in time. Now, tuition has changed back and forth through the years, so I don't know quite how those payments would be being made today. But it created for those of us on education quite an interesting discussion.
Yes, and this legislature many times has approved this concept of tax reciprocity with Wisconsin. Governor Dayton has signed it into law, I don't know how many times. And in good faith, the Commissioner France, Commissioner Bowerly have negotiated. I've been in some of those negotiations, and you wonder why I have so little hair? It's quite obvious.
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, with that, I will lay House File 183 will be laid over as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Item next, we will go to 210. Representative Hertas, if you could please present your bill, 210. And members, we have, this is kind of resident definition day at the Capitol, House File 210, House File 182, and we do have several folks, three folks would like to testify. I would also ask, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or with concerns on either of the bills? Because we would want to get you down here first. I don't see anyone. The department will after the presentation, we will take, we'll actually, then we'll, Representative Hertas moves House File 210. To be later for possible inclusion. And so Representative Hertas will describe his bill, then I will move House File 182 after that. Then we'll take some testimony from the folks I have, and then we'll have the department. Mr. Cummings, do you want to testify after 210 or after we've heard 210 and 182? What do you prefer?
The testimony is written for both bills together.
Okay, so we will go to public testimony, and then the department will wrap it up. Representative Hertas moves House File 210.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you mentioned at the start of our committee meeting, this bill was introduced last session, and this was a reintroduction of a bill that was similar to or to yours or was included in the omnibus tax bill that we all stopped believing in. So anyway, basically what this bill does is make it much easier for people to know and plan with regard to changing residency, not having to go through a 26-point checklist to make sure they're compliant with the department. I like to think of this this bill, Mr. Chair, as the Hotel California Reform Bill. You know, in the song Hotel California, you can check out any time you want, but you can never leave. And essentially, with the 26-point checklist, which is being distributed to you right now, you will see a number of items that the department can use to determine residency. Also, what the department does is it defines in statute residency and domicile, and you'll see that domicile is one of the 26 points as well. So the highlights of it are is that basically any person who desires to leave the state of Minnesota would file an affidavit stating so that they are no longer domiciled in Minnesota. It would require you to not be here 183 days. You'd have to be somewhere else and not in Minnesota. And probably one of the nice provisions about it is it allows people to come back to Minnesota to provide medical treatment for a family member or themselves. Coming to Mayo Clinic, for example, would be permissible to come back to the state for those reasons, and it would not count. I think overall I'd just like to emphasize where we go with our tax policy. We ought to be encouraging people to come back to Minnesota and not keep them out of the state.
And we've had discussion at our last meeting on the estate tax. We heard a little bit about it this morning. And overall, I'd like to make this much cleaner and much more simpler. And I'm sure the department, you'll hear testimony that they don't really use this 26-point list. But if that's the case, then so be it. Let's adopt a bill like this, and let's get it out of the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hertas. Questions for members? If not, we'll go into the Representative Loeffler, and then we'll go into the next bill, and then we'll kind of the same issues here. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hertas, I noticed on line 1.18 to 1.19 that the affidavit is conclusive as to the domicile of the individual and binding on the commissioner in any court. And it feels to me like in reading that whatever someone signs, we're going to trust them 100%. We may not even, by this language, be allowed to audit them. So I think most people are honest and trustworthy, but we know that there are people who can't resist temptation. And so we could have taxpayers who, based on this, wouldn't have to pay income taxes if they just certified that I don't consider Minnesota to be my residence, and they don't have to prove that they have a home anywhere else or indicate any other evidence of residing anywhere else? Am I misinterpreting this?
Representative Hertas?
Well, thank you, Representative Loeffler. You know, you still have to meet the 183 days requirement, and signing an affidavit refers, as my intent was, with regard to the statement about domicile. Now, Minnesota establishes definitions of domicile, and domicile is basically something that is permanently there or affixed, so it's not a motorhome, because you can move that. But there are many people who may choose to come back to Minnesota for a couple months a year, and they may own a lake home or may own a property, and that's considered a domicile if it's used for inhabitants. So that's really the affidavit, I believe, is directed particularly at that issue, and that their primary domicile where they live is not in Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I still would like to get some better legal analysis on this binding on the courts as well as the Department of Revenue in administering this and how that would work.
Do you have a question for staff? Or?
Well, if Mr. Michael's prepared to address that, I don't know that he is. But.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, there are essentially two ways you can be a resident for income tax purposes under current law. There's the domicile test, which is an intent-based test, and then there's the physical presence or statutory test where you're here more than 183 days. What Representative Hertas's bill does with regard to the domicile test is to say that an affidavit filed by the individual is conclusive as to that individual's intent. So, yes, the Department of Revenue would not, under his bill, be able to challenge that intent, but as Representative Hertas says, the department still could fall back to if you were physically present in the state more than 183 days, then you could be a resident based on that. Now, the bill also changes what it takes to be in physically present in the state for a day to be a Minnesota day. You can't just be here for part of a day. You actually have to have an overnight stay. But basically on the domicile test, what it does is it makes the affidavit the final say on what the intent of where the individual intended their permanent home to be, not the sort of common law 20 or the department's administrative rule that looks at all of these other factors to judge what their intent was.
And we will be hearing fully from the department. They will address this. Is that correct, Mr. Cummings? Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. I had a question, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Michael, if you could answer that. Mr. Michael, so if Representative Hertas, the day after we adjourn every year, moved to Florida and then came back when we gaveled in January, Could he essentially benefit from the tax benefits of filing a form like this that would hold up in court? Or are there other factors that I'm not I mean, could legislators do that potentially under the definitions under this bill?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lash, I think a fair reading of the bill is that basically the intent for domicile under the income tax would be determined by what the taxpayer or the individual says in their affidavit. There are all sorts of other residency tests that you have to meet for various other purposes, you know, in order to get in-state tuition at a higher education institution or to be a member of the legislature. Those are separate tests that you would have to independently meet. And what you say on this may affect those other, whether you qualify under those other tests or not.
Well, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that. I think based on Mr. Michael's answer, I wasn't sure whether or not this filing of this affidavit unilaterally overwrote all those other considerations. Yes, there are considerations for residency requirements, for the legislature requirements for residency if you want to get tuition for your kids, all these other benefits that Minnesotans get based on the taxes that we pay, including the $1 billion I think we gave to Mayo. If you want to come up here just to avail yourself of the medical services of Mayo, that are otherwise paid for by taxpayers. For those folks who don't want to pay that, my question was if you still want to serve your community as a legislator but not pay the taxes. I just wondered if that was possible under Representative Hertaus' bill, and it sounds to me like the answer is yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Lesh, I mean, clearly to be a legislator, you have to meet the residency requirements and be in your district. I don't think that example would be one that you could have a Florida resident, for example, be your state representative. So it'd be an interesting proposition, but no, I don't believe that to be the case, and maybe that example is maybe not the best one.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hertaus. Now you got me thinking. I think it's a great example because you have to live here 6 months before the general election. And if you meet that threshold and establish a residency, sure, you could run for a general election and be in Florida most of the time thereafter. So my point is that there may be some edges you want to sand off on this bill. I think you're using a sledgehammer to kill a mosquito on this. And I'm not sure that's necessary because I think you'd be subject to a lot of criticism on the floor for this if you get it through.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Michael, just a quick clarification and my understanding of affidavits, whereas this signing of an affidavit would eliminate the ability of challenging residency or domicile, it doesn't preclude any of the penalties or requirements for perjury. Is that correct?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg, I would say yes, that's correct, that it doesn't have anything, you know. But essentially the issue is with domicile is what do you intend to be your permanent home? And, you know, in some ways, right now the system is that, you know, okay, the taxpayer can say they intend their permanent home to be a state other than Minnesota, but how you prove intent, that their statement's not conclusive. This essentially says their sworn statement is conclusive. I think it would be very hard for a court or a jury to say, well, I suppose in some circumstances, if the person, spent the entire year in Minnesota and doesn't have a home somewhere else, maybe they could question their intent, but maybe your intent is your home is someplace else.
Representative Peter. Okay, with that, we will move on to House File. So, Representative Hertaus moves House File 210 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I will move House File 180. Representative Hertaus, you didn't have any amendments, did you?
I did not.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay, item next, I'll move House File 182, another domicile bill, and I think I'm going to try and get the testifiers on first. Basically, Mr. Michael, 182, a very brief description. This was in the House File 848. said that some people stopped believing in, and I just heard from Rubis that he stopped believing in. I'm questioning his loyalty at this point. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what House File 182 does is it modifies the domicile test to essentially make a handful of business relationships off limits in terms of that 26-factor test that Representative Hertas talked about, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. I will bring, if Therese Kuhas, Minnesota Bankers, and then let's bring down Brian Lake from the Minnesota State Bar Association and Ms. Sandy Niren, Minnesota Society of CPAs. They're the actuaries with the personality. Okay, please start.
My name is Teresa Kuvas. I work for the Minnesota Bankers Association. Thank you, Chair Davids, for continuing to work on this bill. We really appreciate it. This language has been worked on, hard worked on language over the last couple of years. And from the banking industry, we really do appreciate looking at the location of the bank accounts. When this factor test went in the 1980s, banking was very different from what it is today. Now you can bank mobily, internet, and when it's one of the factors on the list, it's an easy one to remove from the list. When you move to Florida, they're being told, just change your bank accounts. And we know that so many people have bank accounts across the country, across the world, and that really the location of where you bank should no longer be one of the main resident factors.
Mr. Lake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Lake, representing the State Bar Association. Thank you once again for working on this, Mr. Chair. From the bar's perspective, you know, the location of a client's attorney is not really necessarily a very good indicator of where the client is located, so it's not really a good factor for residency purposes. So we'd be, I don't think so, a whole bunch. I think most people are pretty familiar with this issue, but once again, very supportive of the issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Niren?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sandy Niren, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants. Mr. Fragnito asked me to express his apologies to you for not personally being here. This bill is very important to the society.
If you could let him know that I've noted that fact.
This bill is, I wanted to clarify, this is the exact same language that was in the 2016 tax bill that passed both the House and Senate. I think it's an identical language. This bill is here because of two Supreme Court decisions back in 2013 that specifically cited the location of the individual taxpayers, certified public accountant, and lawyers as factors of why they were still Minnesota residents. So this bill is here because of Supreme Court decisions. And I do want to make clear to the committee that this bill is not here because of anything that the Department of Revenue has done. They are blameless in this. This is being here because of Supreme Court decisions and the opinion of tax lawyers from the Bar Association that the only way to effectively deal with these Supreme Court decisions is to pass another law. What has happened since those Supreme Court decisions is that professionals in other states are marketing to Minnesota residents, former Minnesota residents who now live in other states, saying you can no longer continue to retain your Minnesota financial planner, your Minnesota CPA, or your Minnesota accountant because of the Supreme Court decisions. They're being used for marketing purposes to draw people away from using Minnesota professionals. And the result adversely impacts small business owners more than any small business CPA firms who don't have presence in other states. So that's why this bill is here. It's because of Supreme Court decisions, not because of anything that the department has done. And this bill is supported, I've been asked to say, by a group of people besides the bankers and bar associations, the Insurance and Financial Services Council, the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents Association, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Business Partnership, the Community Bankers Association, and the Minnesota Credit Union Network. Thank you very much for bringing the bill forward again, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Niren. And I just wanted to clarify for members, maybe ask Mr. Michael, this language in House File 182 is the language from House File 848 regarding this subject. We didn't make any big changes or...
Mr. Chairman, this is the language from the conference committee report of the pocket veto bill. So,
and I'd also like to mention that we worked very closely. This was Senator Ann Rest's language, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes.
Senator Rest had this language. Yeah, yes. Okay. that we worked with the department quite a bit to get this refined. Okay, with that, Mr. Cummings, we are going to go just a little bit beyond. I hope that doesn't mess up too many people's schedules here, but Mr. Cummings, to House File 182, and then we will go to some questions of the department. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please. And I do apologize on that on that last bill where I had a whole long list of folks with questions, so please talk to Mr. Cummings about your questions on that. I don't like doing that, but we kind of need to today. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. So I'll be providing on both comments on both of the residency bills, the one authored by Representative Hertas and the one authored by you, Mr. Chair. Before I begin, I wanted to provide some clarity about a statement put into the record last week in the estate tax discussion. It was stated that the Department of Revenue looks at charitable contributions for the purposes of determining residency. That is not true. The law under Minnesota Statutes 290.01, Subdivision 7, Paragraph C, specifically and explicitly precludes the consideration of charitable contributions in residency determinations, period. Even if the taxpayer asks us to consider their charitable contributions for charities to other states. If you hear this inaccurate statement, say something. Spreading this falsehood hurts Minnesota charities. If you know of anyone whom we can share the correct information, please let us know. Mr. Charity.
Same thing. Same thing.
I will be going back to testimony about this bill at this time. Based on discussions during the 2014 legislative session, the department initiated a review of the residency law, both the statute and the rule, as noted by Representative Hertas, and the department's application of them. The department conducted listening sessions between May and December of 2014. We held six listening sessions with over 100 participants to hear what tax, banking, insurance, and financial professionals think about Minnesota's residency law, as they relate to the Minnesota individual income tax. We issued a report that includes information and feedback gathered during the listening sessions with members of the Minnesota Society of CPAs, Chamber of Commerce, Bar Association, Association of Public Accountants, and the Bankers Association. So that report includes what happened at the listening sessions, the history of residency, how the department approaches residency audits and appeals, how other states determine residency, and then the department's next steps, Mr. Chair. As a result of the valuable information learned while creating this report, the department has made several changes to the process for addressing domicile and residency. Some of the things we heard, Mr. Chair, was both about the actual rule and law, but we also heard about the way in which the department goes about working with some of these taxpayers, and we felt that that was valuable feedback. First, we revised our contact letters and requests for information. We simplified the format, reduced the amount of information we initially requested, and included a set of common questions and answers to taxpayers that they have about the audit process. Second, we modified our questionnaire to collect information in a more efficient manner. We eliminated questions we can verify through other means. Third, we modified our procedures and provided additional training to our employees. Yep. To ensure we have a common standard approach to requesting and reviewing information for residency audits. I went to many of those trainings, and I can tell you, Mr. Chair, that they were in-depth, and I can also tell you, Mr. Chair, that there was a seriousness about ensuring that we are working with these taxpayers in a way that meets our mission and vision as an agency. Fourth, we revised our audit reports to more closely reflect the intent component of domicile. Fifth, we provided taxpayers and representatives with helpful tips for handling a residency audit. Sixth, we updated our website contact and centralized it into a one-stop shop for residency information. Seventh, we issued a revenue notice based on current law and the rule that clearly states employing, hiring, or engaging an attorney or CPA or has a business relationship with an attorney or CPA whose address is in Minnesota does not by itself demonstrate intent to establish or obtain domicile, and having one or more bank accounts in located Minnesota does not by itself demonstrate an intent to establish or retain domicile in Minnesota. We also updated our existing fact sheets and other materials
to include a modernized explanation of how we use certain factors to determine residency. And that can I can describe more of that, or you can read it in the report, which is on our website, Mr. Chair. We believe that identifying the appropriate residency status of taxpayers is important to the integrity and administration of our state tax system. The changes will help ensure consistent, transparent, and fair treatment of all taxpayers, make it easier for taxpayers to understand how residency is determined for taxes, and reduce the time and effort needed for taxpayers who are selected for a residency audit. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to provide some brief testimony about the bills before us today. Verifying the days spent primarily for medical treatment would be challenging for the department and the taxpayer. Excluding medical days spent in the state would lead to very personally intrusive questions during an examination process that would make auditing this criteria very difficult without infringing on privacy issues. I think that Mr. Michael, in a short amount of time, and Ms. Manzi were able to come up with a solution that was very creative, and we look forward to continuing to work with you, Mr. Chair, if this moves forward. Under Representative Hertas's bill, as written, any taxpayer can file an affidavit to exempt oneself from residency and taxation, and this would be something that cannot be audited. As drafted, anyone can file this affidavit, and there's no requirement to meet any standards of residency. As written, any person can relinquish residency for tax purposes regardless of intent to change domicile or any actual change in life. Many times we think residency is an issue that impacts a small class of mobile people, yet residency impacts all Minnesotans. If you are paying your income tax but your neighbor who is present in Minnesota most of the year doesn't have to, it brings up an issue of fairness. As it relates to your bill, Mr. Chair, we want to thank the advocates for agreeing to some common sense changes to the language in your bill that we hope can be included in the omnibus bill, having the determination of domicile apply to all domicile determinations and not just if you are domiciled in Minnesota, and ensuring that the effective date starts at the beginning of the tax year. Mr. Chair, we believe that those are two positive changes. On your bill, Mr. Chair, we also want to ensure that by excluding their physical presence, we are not excluding the physical transactions or declarations made when conducting business, meaning here that if we want to know what to declare when applying for their insurance, the insurance is on the primary residence homesteaded in Minnesota. Having a primary resident homesteaded in Minnesota and that declaration of that is important, but merely having an insurance agent who lives in Minnesota where that declaration was made is not under your bill, Mr. Chair. We also want to remind members that if these factors are excluded from consideration, taxpayers will not be able to use them both ways when making the claim to be a Minnesota resident or a resident of another state. We understand the issues surrounding the claims made by professionals in other states that take one or more of the Minnesota Supreme Court cases out of context. Those cases do not rely on only one factor. The department worked to provide clarity by issuing a revenue notice that will help provide written documentation of Minnesota's requirements. We think that this was the appropriate solution to the issues raised given the state of the current law. We understand, however, that some, including members of this committee, are interested in additional steps, and I know that you put in that bill, Mr. Chair, which precipitated in a language that is agreed to by many individuals. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. Sorry about the length and the quickness, but we look forward to continuing the conversation through session on this bill and other important bills impacting Minnesotans. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you for the information, Mr. Cumming. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Michael and a question for Mr. Cummings, but for Mr. Michael, I read through the document. It says this started in the 1980s. Was it all 26 that was established in the 1980s, or have we added some to the criteria since then?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I believe that the original amended domicile rule, which I think was amended in 1981, did have all I think it had 26 factors. It has been changed a couple times, and the legislature It never included charitable contributions, but the legislature in 2000 or 99 or something like that prohibited the use of charitable contributions, and I think they amended the rule, as you'll see that what was handed out by Representative Hurtas to prohibit that. But I believe the 26 factors have been around since the early 80s.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Michael. And Mr. Cummings, can you tell me what has been, and this is something you'll probably have to get back to me on.
Sure.
But I'm looking for, since 2010, how many FTEs have been dedicated to this for every year leading up until now? And then also in your directives to the staff that are responsible for this side of tax compliance, what are they charged with looking at, and how has that changed over the years since 2010?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cummins? Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, first I wanted to say that as it relates to the rule, as we were doing our research, we found that the rule was helpful for taxpayers in the sense that we were trying to create a rule at that time that talked about what was already in case law. Many times that the rule was actually built based upon what courts had determined over the time in terms of what was helpful. So that was sort of, as we're looking back, how the rules sort of came together. So, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, to your question about the number of FTEs who have been involved in this, and then what are they directed to work on, I will ensure that we can get you a good response to that, but I'll need to go back and make sure that I'm getting you the correct information.
And, Mr. Chair,
Anderson.
Just a quick follow-up, too. I would be interested in knowing if you have looked through this too to see if there's other things that maybe need to be changed on the criteria. And why I ask that is I just think of my own mother. You know, sometimes she lives here in Minnesota, but we still have the mail go somewhere else to one of her children to handle the finances piece. Or even as a status as a student, you know, I remember going to the UMD and I had my checking account still at the home bank because I knew if I ever needed to have money switched, it wasn't going to be a major bureaucratic mess to get money switched from one account to the other. And the benefits of growing up in a small town when you know the banker personally, as you know.
Right.
So, I mean, those are some of the things. I don't know if you've tried to review some of that at all, too, and made some suggestions on that.
Mr. Cumming?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, back in 2014, we did try and take a look at the list to try and see what things have changed within the economy. And I know that that is a lot of what we came in terms of the bill that Representative Davids had, which addresses a number of these factors. There were other factors, Mr. Chair, and I just want to find my place in the testimony. We did look at some of the other factors. So in terms of voter registration, a lot of times people think that this is a checklist, or people are saying, well, if it's 14 of the factors, then does that create sort of a domicile determination? And really the list is to try and to be helpful to think about how do we get to the person's intent in terms of where they live. So one factor is not determinative. But I think that coming brought together, it is sort of just trying to say, what is this person's intent, which can be very hard to figure out. But specifically to your point, factor B, dealing with voter registration. A lot of times if a person is registered, they may not have remembered that they're registered at a place or whatever it turns out. So one of the things is in terms of looking at where you actually vote and when you voted, rather than just where you're registered. Other professional licenses, really looking at the status of your license, active, valid, inactive, invalid, and whether it is for a resident or non-resident. The locations of transactions with financial institutions. We're really going to be looking here at where your transactions occurred. Like, did you take it out of which ATM? But rather than financial institution are you a member of? The location of the place of worship. I know that there are many people who are active in a church. or a member of a church because they're trying to ensure that they continue to have a grave site. But, you know, it is trying to say, well, where have you physically attended? Other locations of the schools, we have online learning now. So you might be physically in attendance at your home, much like our page is talking about. But, you know, the school might be in Pennsylvania, or but you're sitting at a house in Plymouth or in Florida or somewhere. So it is really trying to think about, different ways of thinking about these types of things. And, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, if there are additional ways or different types of feedback that you have, I know that since we started this, we have been trying to do our best to try and figure out this, what is the intent here. And I know it's not easy. It's a hard determination. But we want to try and find a way that is both fair and non-burdensome, but also, you know, fair to all residents of Minnesota, too.
Chair Anderson. Is that the First State Bank of Atwater? Chair Anderson?
Actually, I moved it to Canyon High.
Oh. Ooh. That's a little west. Chair Anderson?
And Mr. Chair, it was the town that my parents had moved to. They moved off the farm, so my brothers had the farm after that.
Okay.
So it was close to home for my mom.
Awesome. Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I'll try to be really quick, and I'd be happy if Mr. Cummins wanted to follow up with me afterwards. But, you know, and I appreciate him raising the issue of the charitable deductions and that not being something that people can look at. But what troubles me a little bit on the number S, the location of place of worship in which a person is a member, is that something where churches provide a list to the department of who their official members are or not? I mean, because for some people, that's part of their charitable giving as well, is the church that they're a member of or tied to. So how is that determined, and how is it verified, and how do you separate that charitable donation from the church or place of worship you may attend?
Mr. Cummings?
Well, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, the in terms of the place of worship, you're right. In terms of what, you know, the fact of whether you're tithing or whether you're giving or whatever that is a different consideration in terms of where you are a member. This is something that is part of the rule. It is also part of an ability for taxpayers to use that as a way to talk about, you know, where their intent is. It's a tool for taxpayers to come forward. So I will have to tell you, though, I mean, in terms of our interaction with churches is something that I don't know the answer to. I can ask that question if people are affirmatively saying I am a member of a church in Florida, and then I don't know if there's a follow-up question there, but I can get back to you, Madam Chair.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would appreciate that, Mr. Cummins. Thank you.
Representative Hertoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Cummins, I just want to clarify something you said. You made an anecdotal example of somebody living next door to someone and somebody spending most of the time here and not paying Minnesota taxes. By that own statement, if they're spending most of the time here in either bill, they're a Minnesota resident. So, you know, that was a little disingenuous there. With regard to factor tests, it's important to note that, you know, with regard to the rules, that in and of itself, you know, won't determine domicile, but Minnesota's been very successful in imposing residency with just a few of the factors on those rules, and that was part of my intent to get rid of all of them because you're using just a few of them. Minnesota Department of Revenue will mail a residency questionnaire to a taxpayer, and then the next step is the Department of Revenue will request them to complete that questionnaire and then send information to support a non-resident claim, and then the burden of proof is on the taxpayer to show the severance of domicile. And again, we've even got things in the list that if you own a vehicle and have it licensed with Minnesota tabs, again, you have people who are not Minnesota residents that own real property in Minnesota. Real property is defined by statute as a domicile, and if you keep a car in there with Minnesota plates on it and paying Minnesota taxes, that's another one of the little factors that they use to try and really claw back and make you a resident. So like I said before, it's you can leave, you can check out, but you can never leave.
Mr. Cummings?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, you know, the binding, the determination that is signed by the taxpayer would be one way for a taxpayer to make a declaration that would be, that I did talk about with the fairness issue. In terms of medical days, there is, depending on how this ends up being written, you know, I know that many people could go and seek medical treatment, and then those would be added on to the 183 days. I mean, so there is a way to say, I know my dad, he goes to get his blood checked every week, and I don't know if those would be counted as medical days or, you know, if that's, so if that's 26 times, you know, plus 183. So we're just trying to ensure that there's clarity. We're trying to ensure that there's fairness. And, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with the committee to ensure that that those happen.
Okay, we're going to go to Graskowski, Metz, and then wrap it up. I'm taking a little bit of liberty on the extra time because we didn't get started until later. So, or Representative Hertas, briefly.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, again, let's point out, I mean, in a routine thing like a lab test, you're not going to travel from another state all the way to come back to Minnesota to get your blood checked. And we're talking about serious things where you can only get this treatment, say, at Mayo Clinic, some type of, you know, laser cancer therapy or something of that nature. So let's be clear about what the medical exemption is about.
Chair Graskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of my question has already been asked or answered, but I think Representative Chair Anderson's question about the number of FTEs dedicated to this area is very salient, and I would remind members that at least my understanding is that this is in rule, this list of 26. It's not in statute. The department developed this over time through rulemaking. There's a lot of swamp water in this list of 26 here, and so I'm curious, Mr. Cummings, when you come forward with those FTEs, how much time they spend and some of the details around how they chase people down about this. I think I like Representative Hertas's approach where we can actually put something in statute that's definitive, and I don't know if it's the proper form yet. It might need some more work. But I prefer that, Mr. Chair, over us having the department continue to do 26 items. I think it's in the best interest of clarity and fairness to the taxpayer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Draskowski. Representative Metz, to wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I don't need an answer today. I was just curious. I've never heard of writing off tithing. And if that is something people are able to do, it would be interesting to see what kind of documentation you were to provide.
Do it every Sunday.
Yeah, that's. I have always thought of tithing as you just give for the sake of giving. So.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I will move the House File 182 as amended to be later for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. We didn't amend it. I will move House File 182 be later for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Tomorrow, members, Social Security Day at the Capitol. Thank you for your time. Deputy Cummings, I'm looking in the future. Mr. Cummings, thank you so much for your work today. And I thank the members. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.